Now I'm a proud instrument builder, and you won't be able to escape from hearing a little bit about the way we're building our instrument, and we'll try to put the slant on what sorts of flexibility we have in that, in the performance of LIGO as it evolves, and to address a little bit the usefulness as a means of detecting R modes. I now know much more about R modes than I did when I woke up this morning, and of course I would write my talk a little bit differently. I would stress some different things now than as you will see I've printed up here. And maybe I'll cheat and send in a PDF file that's a little bit different than the one I've prepared for you. So I'll talk a little bit about LIGO 1 because it's fun to look at and because it's what we have. And we'll be working with it for a number of years. We should think about what we can do with it that's good and interesting. But then mostly talk about a second generation LIGO. What's the status of LIGO as it is initially designed? The facility infrastructure is complete, and I don't know how many of you have been to one of the sites. They're fun to go to, and you're all welcome to go and take a tour and look around and even do a little bit of C++ coding if you want. there's one up in desert highlands in Hanford, Washington, and the other one's in a swamp with some cows around it in Livingston, Louisiana. There will be ultimately two complete interferometers, a 2 kilometer and a 4 kilometer one in this installation. And one complete interferometer is there and it's in the process of being debugged. Another half an interferometer is installed for the second interferometer. And then down in Livingston, the one interferometer is almost completely installed and some commissioning is going on, some testing of the subsystems. We haven't seen any catastrophes yet, and we could have seen quite a number. The mirrors, which have lead times of years, could have been polished to the wrong radius of curvature. A lot of things have gone right that could have gone wrong, and I can't say that we've seen every little bit where all the corners where things could go wrong, but we've seen a lot. And so we're quite encouraged that we'll be able to stick roughly to our schedule for bringing the systems initially online. Give you a brief reminder of our basic layout. This is a schematic diagram of the interferometer. An optimally oriented gravitational wave would come into this page here and appear to shorten this arm and lengthen this arm for one phase of the gravitational wave. So there'd be a difference in the round-trip travel time for light beams, and so we measure that distance using a frequency-stabilized laser, send light into these two arms, and then compare the difference of the phases on this beam splitter here, which subtract the phases, and then look at variations of intensity here. We do several things to increase the size of the signal. We make the arms as long as we can afford, about 4 kilometers, still much, much shorter than the wavelength of any gravitational waves you expect to detect with this, hundreds of kilometers. We store the light in a cavity for effectively some 150 or so round trips to increase the phase change that the light experiences due to the gravitational wave. And we also impedance match the laser light to the losses of the system by including a recycling mirror. It basically reflects the light back in an in-phase way to reinforce the light intensity here. The light then is detected in a photodetector and is whoever's transcribing this is going to take off their headphones at this point. There we go. Good. And so the interferometer up at Hanford, which has been made, is one that's 2 kilometers long. The 4 kilometer one is in construction. Now, we've already got an entire arm, a 2 kilometer long arm, resonating along and illuminated by a highly frequency stabilized laser. Give you a sense of the subsystems that have been tested. So the mirrors are suspended as pendulums to allow them to make them free in space and to also allow orientation and control signals to be applied to them. Those systems all seem to be functioning correctly. We've started to make models of the environment. Here's a fun plot, by the way. Over the period of a day, we find that the length of this 2 kilometer arm cavity varies in a sinusoidal sort of way. There's an overall slope to this that just has to do with the frequency shift of the laser, but this thing with the period of 12 hours is the tidal strain over the 2 kilometer baseline. The length changes by a few hundred microns, and we're able to track that very easily with our sensitivity of 10 to the minus 12 microns or whatever it is, 10 to the minus 18 meters per root hertz or so. The laser is clearly working well. The intensity fluctuations have been characterized. The mirrors, as I said, work correctly, both their losses and their figure, which is correct to about lambda over 1,000, about a nanometer over a period of centimeters. It's good. The control systems are just being brought online now, and while we see that all the signals are there, we're not yet locking the entire complicated interferometer with its coupled modes. We're just addressing that at this very minute up at Hanford. And there's a beautiful data acquisition system and a bunch of software tools that make the work on this interferometer a very different thing than the old-fashioned tabletop prototypes where you actually had to have your hands on mirrors. People now sit in front of computer screens and analyze their data. We've made the first of what will be a long series of engineering runs. We've had this 2-kilometer arm running for roughly 24 hours. And it's really to characterize the detector at this point. For a number of reasons, you wouldn't do a serious search for gravitational radiation in a single arm interferometer, all isolated. But it does allow us to develop algorithms both for the analysis of the detector and for people who are interested in data analysis to look at something that has a time series that resembles something like the one that we'll have. It's an excellent way for people who haven't been so involved in the hardware to learn how the system works. Any interested physicist who's involved in the LIGO Science collaboration, come and contribute, drink a lot of coffee, stay up all night, and then look at the data. There's various formalities involved in getting actual access to the data. But there will be a whole series of these engineering runs as we come to more and more complete interferometers. I think the next one will be in a number of months and will be on a complete interferometer with differential sensing, so something which could detect a gravitational wave. Not that anybody should take an inventing it seriously. And then ultimately by science runs, when the two interferometers are up and running in coincidence, and running in coincidence also with detectors throughout the world. This talk is, I should put in a caveat, is very LIGO-centric. The fundamental physics, that detection physics that limits us is the same throughout the world. I know about the LIGO detector, so that's not what I'm going to talk about. But of course, GEO or Virgo or TAMA all have similar goals and varying timescales to get to them. Here's the goals for the LIGO 1 performance. All of the plots I'll show you, the few that I'll show you, have a vertical scale of the strain in a 1 hertz bandwidth, not a characteristic amplitude. And you have to do your own integral to find out what this characteristic, what the characteristic amplitude would be for the detection of a given signal. On a logarithmic frequency scale, we see that there's an overall envelope of sensitivity, which in the case of LIGO 1 is limited at low frequencies by seismic noise, just the shaking of the test masses by the mostly human-induced noise around the site. There's a limited region where we're limited by the KT noise in the masses, their equilibrium with the heat bath. And then at high frequencies, it's limited by the number of photons that we count per second and the fluctuations therein. It's just Poisson statistics. There are a whole bunch of other underlying noise sources. I'm going to talk about them in a little bit more detail for our next generation interferometer, so I won't go through them here. The one thing I do want to point out on this graph is what we think the limits are to the LIGO facility, things which are sort of independent of our ability to build interferometers but have to do with where we are. There's the gravity gradient. These are the fluctuations in the quasi-static gravitational field that have to do with the passing clouds, the compression and rarefaction, is that the word, of the ground around the site, which change the net direction that the pendulum is pulled. And those get larger and larger at low frequencies and probably form a limit to how low you can do interferometry on the ground. Maybe with an array of seismometers, you could make yourself sensitive down another factor of 2 in frequency, but that's about it. To go much lower, you should go to space. There's some stray light issues having to do with light in bouncing around the beam tube, which is 1.4 meters in diameter and has a bunch of baffling inside it. Carefully designed by Kip Thorne and other than, but it has a limit to how well it suppresses reflected light and ultimately will be a source of noise. And then the scintillation of the gas in the tube. If we pump as hard as we possibly can with all of the vacuum ports on our pump, on our tube, we'll still find that there are some residual molecules of air in the light path, and they have an index of refraction. As they pass through the light beam, they change the apparent path and mimic a gravitational wave, and that's a noise source. So those would be wonderful limits to reach. And our goal is to find the technologies that will allow us to push down to these limits. With our LIGO, second generation LIGO, we're approaching some of those limits, in particular the gravity gradient, not quite at them yet. So here's a rough plot of what we hope to do in the next improvements to the LIGO installed detector, given this infrastructure. And I'm going to talk about, here's where you get more technology than you really wanted. I'm going to talk about what we do in each one of these domains to try and push down the noise. And I'll refer back to this view graph from time to time. Let's look at it for a bit, though. There's a little bit of lousy translation of MATLAB plots here. This is, again, the strain per root hertz, strain in a 1 hertz bandwidth, 10 to the minus 24, 10 to the minus 23, 10 to the minus 22. the overall envelope for one optimization of the detector looks like this. And again, at some very low frequencies, it's limited by seismic noise, at intermediate frequencies by thermal noise of various kinds, and then the shot noise and the complementary quantum noise determine the envelope in the upper frequency region. Let's look at each one of those in a little bit more detail. Now, the optical configuration is going from the interferometer that I showed you before, which had a recycling mirror to reuse the light and arm cavities to store the light in the two arms, to one where there's also a signal recycling mirror that forms an additional cavity, which can be made resonant or, in fact, anti-resonant for the gravitational waves. The gravitational waves shift the light frequency by ever so slightly, and you can make a resonant cavity which either builds up that intensity or sucks it out preferentially. And in that way, you can change the frequency sensitivity of the instrument. And here's a rough sketch with no correct vertical scale versus frequency, which show the sort of range of responses that you can hope to get with a signal recycled interferometer. And it's nice to see there are two complementary things that are going on here. There's the shot noise, which is the photon counting noise, the number of photons. And you can give yourself a preferentially large number of photons to count at a frequency of interest. And you can change this frequency of interest by shifting the position of the signal recycling mirror. You can also change the width of the curve by changing the transmission of the signal recycling mirror. So you have some flexibility, not infinite flexibility, because in fact what you're doing is building up the light intensity inside the interferometer here, and thermal and absorption in the optical substrates limits how much circulating power you can have before the system becomes unstable. The lensing of the material due to the heating causes the beam to defocus in a way that you can't recover. There's a complementary thing, which is the radiation pressure noise. These masses are being buffeted by photons, and in fact, that gives you a, in a very simple interferometer at least, a white noise force, shakes the mirror. That shaking rolls off as something like 1 over f squared, again, in a simple interferometer. In this one with the signal recycling, the radiation pressure force has got a somewhat more complicated form, and these two noise sources sum to give you the net sensing noise. And you could call this a naive quantum limit. It's the best that you can do is allowed by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Now, Kip has recently in his group done some very careful calculations on this, which show some sort of 10% differences from this way, this sensitivity envelope. I don't know how they work, but they're not a significant influence on the way you can detect things. They'll eventually be incorporated in the models. And then ultimately, you could get beyond this noise-limiting source by using a prepared light, a squeezed light. That's well beyond any technology that we expect to be able to incorporate in the next generation of LIGO interferometers. I mentioned in passing, so let's see, let's look at the noise curve and just see what I was talking about there. This is the shot noise for one tuning of the interferometer, the photon counting noise, and this is the radiation pressure noise. And you can see the radiation pressure noise is coming to be close to being the limiting noise source down here at this very interesting frequency range around 10 hertz. The shot noise is clearly the limit for all of these higher frequencies, and in this particular optimization, which is made to maximize the distance which one can see neutron star in spirals, the minimum in sensitivity is brought up to this frequency to closely track other noise sources, like the thermal noise that we'll talk about.
Which of the two competing suspension designs for
this
one?
This. We refer to those not as suspension designs, but as isolation system designs. Maybe it's a fine distinction, but it's on the outside. Both of the isolation systems limit the influence of mechanical noise to frequencies below 10 hertz, and so they don't even show up on this plot. We'll talk about how we chose that frequency a little bit later on, but it has no influence on that whatsoever. Okay. I mentioned that you have to that there are limits to the amount of circulating power that you can have, and that there's this trade between the shot noise and the radiation pressure. It looks to us like the best power to target for second generation LIGO, if it uses sapphire test masses, it's a question of what kinds of substrates you have and how much absorption you have in them, is 180 watts. If you tried to deliver more power, which would allow you to lower the shot noise curve, then we would have thermal focusing that would be out of control. As it is, we have active focusing of the beam to try and keep it under control. So that it's the limit of the absorption in materials that keeps us to that limit. So if, that sounds like a grungy mechanical system, and you could, in fact, hope to make some progress by learning more about material science. But again, on the scale of LIGO 2, we can't hope to make fundamentally new materials. The material of choice for the test mass is probably sapphire. In LIGO 1, we used fused silica, basically optical glass, and the mass was about 10 kilograms, 25 centimeters in diameter, 10 centimeters thick. We want to use a larger mass in the case of LIGO 2 so that the buffeting from the photons makes a smaller displacement of the mass. It lowers this lowers the noise in the low frequency regime. It happens that sapphire is also good from the standpoint of thermal noise. It has a very high conductivity and relatively low mechanical losses, which means that its coupling to the heat bath gives a relatively small displacement, physical displacement of the mirror surface. It's a subtle thing because there are a lot of different mechanisms that actually lead to the coupling to the heat bath. And our eminent colleague Vladimir Boginsky recently reminded us that the thermoelastic noise is an important one. The bottom line, though, is that sapphire still gives the best noise performance for the sources that we know of now, and we intend to pursue it. The sapphire is better in that way. It is, on the other hand, hard to use. It's anisotropic. It has a birefringence. It's not so easy to come by pieces of sapphire that are large enough and which have high enough optical quality. It's extremely it's a hard surface, mechanically hard, so it's difficult to polish. So we have a lot of development to go before we can even say that we're sure we can use sapphire. An alternative is to use fused silica, as effectively just continue to use glass at a larger piece. On the other hand, that would make a trade in the sensitivity as a function of frequency. Here are a couple of curves that help you decide which one you want to use. This is an overall noise curve using fused silica instead of sapphire. You probably don't remember the other curve well enough. So here's just a comparison of the net response for either a fused silica or a sapphire detector. And you can see that the sapphire lower thermal noise allows a somewhat better sensitivity by factors of 2 or 3 at the best frequency. And it's as you get to higher and higher frequencies, if you were to move the tuning frequency to higher frequencies, which may be interesting, particularly for arm mode detection, you'd be able to profit from the lower internal thermal noise of sapphire. The internal thermal noise of fused silica is going at this with this functionality at this level. The internal thermal noise of sapphire is higher at low frequencies, but lower at high frequencies. And so you could tune to a lower dip at higher frequencies using sapphire. So we intend to use sapphire if we could develop it. That looks like it's best. It does, in fact, increase the noise somewhat at these to use sapphire in these lowest frequency regimes. You do still see neutron stars further with sapphire, and that's a source where the sensitivity at low frequencies is sensitive. So let's look back at my master curve again and see what we've covered. We had the shot noise that we discussed, and then this is the internal thermal noise that we have just decided to use, for which we decided to use sapphire instead of the fused silica that would be like this. I just decided, would prefer to use, we'll follow an aggressive development scheme. If we fail, then we'll fall back to fused silica, at least for the first inception of the second generation of LIGO. The suspensions, we call the suspensions the things that are right very close to the test mass. The test mass is typically a cylinder. It's suspended in LIGO 1 by a steel belt, a piece of piano wire actually, which then allows it to move in all degrees of freedom, many degrees of freedom. In the case of LIGO 2, we'll make it a multiple pendulum, and we'll change from steel to fused silica fibers for the suspension. Again, it's a question of the mechanical properties. You want very, very low mechanical loss to concentrate the thermal energy in a narrow region. It's a technology that the folk at GEO have been preparing for the GEO 600 interferometer, and they're going to be major partners in providing the suspension to the next generation LIGO. The result is that the anticipated contribution from the suspension thermal noise is relatively small in the overall budget. It can be low enough so that your quantum noise limited over a very broad frequency range this radiation pressure noise is actually going to dominate over the suspension noise in the low frequency regime. But now you see the kinds of things that are limiting our low frequency response, and that has a very big effect on how far you can see the inspiraling binaries. Lastly comes this question of the seismic noise. Looking at this curve, we consider to be seismic noise is an engineering quantity. We should be able to turn a knob and figure out what the right frequency is. It's not one of these things which depends on fundamental questions of material science or quantum optics. And so we ask ourselves, how low should we put this limit? Or let me put it differently. How high can we make this limit, because it gets technically easier as the frequency gets higher, without seriously impacting our sensitivity to gravitational waves, not knowing much about the sources of gravitational waves? And our conclusion was that 10 hertz was a pretty good bet. You want to make sure that you're not impacting the system at a frequency close to its best sensitivity. Down here at 10 hertz, you're orders of magnitude above the best sensitivity, and at a level where it's relatively unlikely there will be gravitational wave sources. One argument for moving down in frequency might be periodic sources of perhaps not very great magnitude, but ones which you could observe for very long periods of time to increase your integrated sensitivity. The astrophysicists with whom we consulted made it sound as though we really were not doing a bad thing if we limited our sensitivity to 10 hertz, since we can't do anything about the other noise sources at this point. They're as high as 10 to the minus 22. So we've chosen an isolation system which effectively makes a vertical brick wall at 10 hertz. And the way we've chosen to do it is with servo systems. In LIGO 1, we just use multiple compressive isolation stages, basically oscillators above their natural frequency. The filter is sort of 1 over F squared. Reasonably good, but has some technical difficulties and very difficult to bring to lower frequencies. What we've decided to do for LIGO 2, here's a sketch of such an isolation system in one of our vacuum systems cut away. I'm not sure I'll be able to explain it clearly. There is a rigid stage which is suspended from a series of springs with cantilevers, and it has natural resonant frequencies around 3 hertz. But then you put very sensitive seismometers on that stage, sense the motion with respect to inertial space, and then supply a feedback signal to bring that, to slave that platform to follow the inertial mass. And so you can do as well as you have servo gain to hold the system to that inertial mass and the quietness of the inertial mass. So you go through a couple of stages of that, and you find that you can make this optics table effectively still in inertial space, more still than the other technical noise sources for frequencies higher than 10 hertz. Yes, electronic feedback. So you buy a seismometer from a seismometer outfit, and you buy a bunch of gain, and then you send some current to a voice coil actuator, which exerts a force between the outside world and the suspended platform. Well, let's see. The unity gain frequency for the servo loops is on the order of 50 hertz. I think actually the more useful question is by how much do you suppress the noise? And at 10 hertz, one is suppressing the noise by about a factor of 1,000 or so. And then the remaining isolation comes from this chain of multiple pendulums that form our suspension, the thing getting down close to the test mass. Another important thing, though, is actually to reduce the motion at very low frequencies, at a tenth of a hertz and below, where the ocean waves are causing the motion of the test masses to be difficult to control, to hold the interferometer at the correct operating point. There, the servo system is really ideal. You have a very good sensing signal-to-noise ratio. It's easy to get lots of gain in the servo system, and you can suppress the noise by 6 orders of magnitude, say. And so there I've explained to you why it is that seismic noise does not appear on this plot, because it's below 10 hertz and effectively has no influence on your ability to detect gravitational waves. If, for instance, you calculate a distance to which you can see neutron in spirals and you slide this wall up, you find that you don't make more than a 5% change until you get to 30 hertz. It's because all of the sensitivity is coming from this region here, adding a little bit of frequency range at this very poor sensitivity just doesn't change your sensitivity to gravitational waves. One other thing you could look at is the sensitivity to stochastic noise sources, assuming with usual naivete that omega is flat. You could say that you might expect the noise from a stochastic, the signal from a stochastic background to rise just about at, with a characteristic frequency like this. Again, this thermoelastic noise and the radiation pressure act as a virtual cutoff, so that having a sensitivity below 20 or 30 hertz doesn't make any difference. 10 hertz looks to us like a safe choice. And it's a different one than the choice that the Virgo people have made. And it's one of the questions we asked ourselves. You're not very interested in this chart. It shows a whole bunch of numbers indicating, extracting a few signal numbers from those sensitivity charts and showing the various ways that we've changed the infrastructure to get the sensitivity that we anticipate. You can peruse that once these things go up on the website or ask me questions about it later on. A timeline, the most optimistic schedule that we could imagine is something like this. We're working hard on LIGO 1, and it's actually going pretty well. And we believe that we will be completely installed and completely commissioned by sometime in 2001. And we'll have actually done a lot of engineering runs in Quidston between the two sites, so that by 2002, we would have something we would call a real operating detector, something that's working most of the time, that is to say, a pair of sites working most of the time at a design sensitivity comparable to our final design sensitivity, which is sensitivity and strain of some 3 × 10⁻²³ hertz in a 1 hertz bandwidth. And then the science run will continue for a few years. And our initial plan had us wrapping up our science run in 2003, but that was without having given a lot of thought to what it really meant to build a second generation LIGO. We now think that it's unreasonable to try to build something new before, say, 2005. So it looks like we'll have something like 3 years of science running with LIGO 1. Meanwhile, we're working hard on the research and development for a second generation LIGO. And in 2002, we think we'll start getting into the very serious hardware design and acquiring some of the longest lead items, for instance, sapphire test masses and so forth. Fabrication will start in earnest in 2003, again, in this most optimistic schedule. The notion is that somewhere in 2005, you would have built up a whole bunch of the systems, mechanical systems, staged them on site, and in as quickly as possible in one of the interferometers, remove all of the components, replace them with the second generation, and start to commission that interferometer, probably doing one site, leaving the other site running in coincidence with our collaborators, GEO and Virgo and TAMA, so that there'd still be a network of interferometers running. And then pending how well that first set of improvements went, we would then jump to the other interferometer and bring them both to the same level, possibly making 3 interferometers or 2 interferometers. It's a science question. Is it worthwhile to have 3 identical interferometers? Should we have 2 fixed interferometers and a third one, which is available for making more changes? Let me go back now to the earlier slide. Oh, and I say this is most optimistic. My guess is that it'd be very easy for the NSF and Congress to tell us that we should get a little bit more out of LIGO 1 before being so sure we know what we want to build for LIGO 2. And so this is the most optimistic schedule. Let's look for a couple of minutes at this sensitivity curve, and let me tell you how I think we can change things. What sort of flexibility do we have in the sensitivity? First off, there's the set of different curves for different tunings of the signal recycling mirror. Maybe Patrick will say a little bit more about this. 1 minute, okay. And we can fairly easily, in the technology that we'll propose, change the center frequency of this dip, and it would carve out a locus of points more or less constant in sensitivity between roughly 200 hertz and kilohertz or so. If we made an increment in the complexity of our technology so that we could vary the transmission of the output coupling mirror, then we'd also be able to change in a complementary way the width of the peak and its depth, and could then trace out something which would follow for a little bit more time this limit to sensitivity from the internal thermal noise. We probably won't be able to do anything better with internal thermal noise, perhaps a square root of 2 or so in anything we could propose for LIGO 2, even though there are some clever ideas about changing the beam format. You could cool the mirrors. And there are a lot of things that dreamers could come up with, which will certainly be part of some future ground-based interferometer, but which we can't, in a reasonable way, propose for the next generation of LIGO interferometers and maintain the schedule that I said on the previous page. So I think we have to take a limit at around this level very seriously. Squeezed light to reduce then this photon pressure is something which, again, has been demonstrated in the laboratory on almost loss-free optical systems. To incorporate it into a full-scale interferometer is not impossible, but something which is off our horizon for something that would be running between, say, the years of 2006 and 2010, your graduate students. And then the suspension thermal noise, again, cooling is probably a means to reduce it in its intensity, and it probably is subject to engineering. So I think we could say that this is something we could move if there were a reason to move it. But we don't have a lot of flexibility for what we'll be installing in sort of 2005, 2006. I have a last slide, which is one that actually Daniel Sig, a great physicist up at Hanford, just put together for a talk he gave at SLAC. We expect sort of a 20-year lifetime for LIGO. And it's built to last. And here are a bunch of the trial by fire that has already been through. As I think you all know, there was a huge fire at the Hanford site, and it's completely surrounded. This is a view from the observation deck on top of the central building when this fire was burning, and the charred remains of the desert shrubbery, which is afterwards. It's on a government site where there's the reprocessing of nuclear waste, and they periodically have scrambles for the security force to show how they would respond to a terrorist attack. And so they in the middle of the night, a bunch of them had maps, and they had their lines all drawn out about where they were going to drive. The map was a little bit out of date. So this poor fellow came charging across the desert at who knows what speed, and he was fine, I'm very pleased to say. Seat belts and airbags and so forth and so on. They had some difficulty getting the car out. And the interferometer happened to be locked at the time that hit the beam tube, and it did not knock it out of lock. Of course, it was kilometers away from either one of the two end stations, so. It was visible, yes. But, and we saw a coincidence between the seismometers. And so there you have it. Thank you. Please.
Have you considered magnetospheric effects? The mechanical
isolation. Tell me more what you mean. You mean an influence on the test masses due to magnetic fields, or? The LIGO 1 test masses have forces applied to them for the control systems through small permanent magnets that are glued to the back of the mirror. And then there are voice coils which are sitting on an outside frame, and that exerts the forces. And so while those magnets are set up as a quadrupole, so they're, ostensibly a uniform magnetic field would have no net force, of course there's lots of steel around which makes even a constant magnetic or a flat magnetic field twist, and it could exert forces. We believe that those forces are dropping off quickly enough with frequency, they in general, mostly due to fans and so forth in the infrastructure, right? I mean, that's most of the fields are at 60 hertz, 120 hertz, 360 hertz. The ones that are due to natural phenomena, things like sunspots and so forth and so on, are very weak fields and at very low frequencies, well below the sort of 40 hertz lower frequency cutoff of LIGO 1. But the signals are extraordinarily small compared with what we're producing in our own laboratory.
Well, small.
It's also small. The thing which overwhelmingly dominates are magnetic fields due to motors that turn fans that are circulating clean air within the laboratory. And those will make peaks in our response spectrum at 60 hertz and 180 and so forth. And on the other hand, we will be able to track them in their phase and amplitude with independent monitors, and they can be removed from the data stream and used to veto. Right. And maybe, I mean, another thing which we most certainly will see as movements of the test masses are magnetic fields due to lightning strikes. And in fact, it's interesting, if you have a lightning strike in Omaha, it will show up in the two detectors with a time delay that has to do with the speed travel to the speed of light due to motion of the detectors. We have a huge range, though, of sensors at each one of the two sites to act as, in the crudest sense, veto, for instance, radios, which then have narrow-banded signals sent down to the DAC. There are magnetic field sensors, there are seismometers, there are microphones. If it rains, it makes a lot of noise, and we'll be able to track that with the microphones. So in the crudest sense, you'll know when to exclude data and when to exclude coincidences by looking at these auxiliary signals. In a more sophisticated analysis, you actually put them into the regression and maybe be able to pull them out.
I can tell you that Michael Strike, as far as below
millisecond,
up to 10 to 20,000. So, if you run all across your X-axis.
Right. They are periodic. They're at a level that we can accept. I mean, we've done a study of the lightning strikes because it's clearly something of importance. And we think with the combination of our local sensors and the wonderful advantage of having our two separate detectors that it won't have a significant impact on our observing time. It will be a signal which will be one of the many signals that we'll have to eliminate as a gravitational wave candidate because it just won't be believable. We haven't thought of everything, clearly, but that's one that we have thought of. Other questions?
So the effect specifications for LIGO 2 change as a result of the science run of LIGO 1?
It's interesting. We don't have a lot of flexibility in what we can build. Right? I mean, LIGO 1 was built at the limit of our technical ability, and LIGO 2 will again probably be at the limit of our technical ability. And the one thing that I see as a knob that we can turn is the sensitivity at maximum frequency. That's right, the maximum sensitivity at a given frequency. And one of the ways in which both astrophysical theorists, as well as, if there's detection in LIGO 1, it'll turn all of our plans on its head in a most agreeable sort of way. That's a disruption I'd love to see. Since we don't know what to plan for the unexpected, we plan for the expected, which is no detection, and make the best system technically that we can. The thing that, for instance, UFO can tell us is to come up with some predictions in which we all have real confidence for frequencies and probabilities of signals at particular different places in the frequency spectrum, and that might induce us either to change the transmission of an output coupling mirror or to introduce an additional technical complexity in the form of a variable output coupling mirror to, for instance, really target very good sensitivity in a narrow band at a high frequency. If we had a known narrow band source from some other astrophysical observation which showed a spin down rate that looked like it was consistent with gravitational radiation and at an amplitude that we thought we could detect, and it was at 1,030 hertz, we'd order a mirror for that. And so getting more information, getting more input is useful, but that's just about the only knob we can turn. Useless in what? Are they a nuisance? They're narrow band. We will track them independently in LIGO 2, at least, with separate sensors, so that their phase will be known as well as their amplitude, and so they can be eliminated from the spectrum at least as a candidate, right? They carve out a little bit of the spectrum, but I think it's actually a very, very small amount of the spectrum itself, right? The suspension fibers are excited by thermal noise, and they exhibit harmonic motion at the fundamental frequency and then higher ends, and they appear as a forest of spikes, which on a logarithmic plot start out being rather sparsely spaced here in the few hundred hertz region, and then become very finely spaced at higher frequencies. But I think they actually fill up a very small amount of the frequency space. Mm-hmm.